This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. It is a new era. After 108 years without a championship, the Chicago Cubs won the World Series last night, thus ending baseball's most famous drought, which means somebody has to take over as America's new lovable loser. I, of course, thought of the Seattle Mariners. But writer and radio host John Moe, a former Seattleite, says maybe this is Canada's moment.
I mean, the obvious candidate, I think, would be the Montreal Expos, because they have not only the challenge of never having won a World Series ever, but also the added challenge of not existing.
Yes.
They have left town, so they would have to relocate to Montreal.
And then the World Series.
And then win the World Series, yeah.
For those who don't know, the Montreal Expos never won in their existence, and they're now basically the Washington Nationals, right?
They're the Washington Nationals. Yeah, although I really love their old logo of that. Remember that weird-looking M?
Yep.
That they had for years, well into adulthood. I thought it was ELB. I didn't realize that it's spelled M. I'm like, what is Elb Canadian for baseball team or something? So they've always been wrapped in mystery. Yeah. You know, barring the reemergence of the Montreal Expos, I would like to say it's the Mariners, but, you know, I don't know that the rest of the country will cotton to the idea of the lovability of the Mariners.
Why would they not? We've never even been to the World Series. The Cubs had been before.
Right. I think the Mariners and Seattle, really, it's still seen as cool and wealthy. And I think that's hard to overcome. It's like rooting for your boss. You know, it's a little bit.
So Chicago seemed to be like Rust Belty or past
Rust Belty. I've always thought that just the idea that it was the Cubs too kind of had some power on it, because they're little baby bears.
Yeah,
and so you root for them. And as you know, Bill, once Cubs players reach a certain age, they are mandated to go play for the Chicago Bears in the NFL.
They grow up into Chicago Bears?
Yeah, it's the rules. It's nature. They have to go do it. They have no choice.
Right. If it were the baby Mariners or the Marinettes, maybe
right,
you'd get something.
Right. The Martinettes. Yeah, I think if it was the Mariners, I think what the Mariners need to do is they need to revert to some of those old terrible uniforms, and they need to put the tugboat back out in the outfield. Mm-hmm. that would like shoot a cannon or something when there was a home run. So I think they need to be a little cornier. Mm. But failing that,
how about the Cleveland Indians?
Yeah. I really wanted to think good thoughts about the Cleveland Indians, and I don't spend a lot of time watching baseball on TV as much as I used to. And so I was watching this series, and they have the guy, the Chief Wahoo,
yeah,
Art. And like, if you haven't seen that in a while, and then you do, you're like, my God, like, they really still have that prominently displayed everywhere they go. I think in the contemporary world that we live in, I think that's going to be a little hard to get past for a lot of people. I mean, the Mets would be a candidate, but they just won. So I don't know. You know, I'm here in Minnesota, and we just got a new sort of general manager for the Twins, a new head of baseball operations, I think. It's this guy from Cleveland, so I guess he starts today. But when the Minnesota Twins were looking for a candidate to run their whole baseball operation, the owner actually said, we want somebody lovable. Lovability was a factor in the hiring, which of course made everybody say, oh, so we're just going to lose really badly all the time.
Yes, right. Lovable goes with loser.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I don't know how lovable this guy is, but apparently it was a priority.
John, the first thought I had when I found out this morning that Cleveland had lost was that Ohio is going to be angry, and how will that affect the election? Do you cover the world outside of sports? Do you think there's a political fallout?
I think with the way the Cleveland Cavaliers won the NBA title and LeBron leaving and then coming back, I think at this point the state of Ohio is so deeply psychologically damaged, plus, you know, the alteration in the economy for manufacturing jobs. I don't think anything can make Ohio more more unstable than it already is. So, you know, you can't, it's like something being more on fire. It's on fire or not.
John Moe is a radio host and a writer. He used to live in Seattle. He used to work at KOW Seattle. Now lives in St. Paul, Minnesota. What do you think, KOW's Derek Wong? Mariners, the new America's new sad sacks?
I don't know. I think fans of the Sonics or even the Metropolitans might be more aggrieved.
Good point. Good point. By the way, that's Derek Wong, who is KOW's assignment editor, joining us from the newsroom because, as of this morning, there have been about 1.5 million ballots cast in this year's November election, less than a week away now from the deadline. And, Derek, there's been some confusion about how people should vote. Should you use the mail? Should you use a drop-off location? What do people do?
I know, it gets really confusing. Well, at this point in time, we are less than 7 days away from the deadline to turn in your ballot. State officials say you should use the drop-off location. Don't put it in the mail, they say. That's because you run the risk of getting a bad postmark, or maybe you don't have enough stamps and maybe it might not go through.
Yeah, speaking of not enough stamps, that has been an issue this year locally.
That's right. So three counties in Washington, Snohomish, Douglas, and Whatcom, they have a ton of local ballot measures that has made their ballots heavier than normal. Mm-hmm. So it costs more than it's one stamp to deliver it. But the Postal Service has always said they'll deliver the ballot anyway.
Yes, even those that don't have any stamps, didn't they tell us if you don't put a stamp on, your vote will be counted?
Exactly. Now, we have heard from people saying, hey, KOW, you're telling us I don't need to put a stamp on my ballot, but you know what? I tried that, and it's been returned, so what's going on?
Right.
We put that question to the Postal Service, and they said, you know, that's surprising to us. That's not supposed to be how it's supposed to work. It's supposed to, our carriers are supposed to deliver all the ballots, and then we bill the county, but that's not happening 100%. So that gets back to the original question of why elections officials are saying, just use the Dropbox. It's just easier.
Yeah. This is not a correction. The KOW story was correct that officially you're supposed to be able to put no stamp on your ballot and still have it get there. But life isn't perfect. And in fact, a Snohomish County councilman tested it out.
Exactly. Just today, the Herald reported that County Councilman Hans Dunshi put his ballot in the mail without any stamps, and it was returned to him. And that he wasn't happy about that.
Right. Snohomish County officials even argued about this issue.
That's right. And part of the reason for the whole debate in Snohomish County is who pays for the postage when it's missing. What's supposed to happen is the Postal Service bills the county. And some county council members earlier this year were like, should we tell people about this? Because if we do, then our tab's going to run up.
Right.
Ultimately, they lost that fight. And the auditor's office there did publicize, hey, you don't need two stamps. But you know what? We were still getting calls from listeners in Snohomish County saying, what am I supposed to do?
Bottom line about what you're supposed to do, Derek, don't use the mail anymore. I mean, yes, you could get it postmarked by Tuesday, mm-hmm. but the best advice is to just use a drop-off box now.
Exactly. State officials, ever since we switched to this all vote-by-mail system, state officials have always said, 1 week out from Election Day, just use the drop-off site.
KUOW's assignment editor Derek Wong has you covered. Thank you, Derek.
Thanks.
Deadline to turn in your ballot is Tuesday, 8 p.m. If you just want to use the mail, you want it to be postmarked by Tuesday. This is KUOW's The Record. Next week, Seattle resident Tracy Rector returns to the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota. You know, thousands of people, including Native Americans from tribes all over the country, are protesting this oil pipeline they say threatens drinking water from the Missouri River and desecrates sites. Tracy Rector is a curator and a filmmaker, and she says the pipeline protest is a historical moment, and she doesn't want her 15-year-old son to miss it.
What's happening now in general, in terms of social justice and politics and environmental health in our world, is at a tipping point. And I want my son to experience firsthand how he can affect change, how he can be a voice, how he can be a witness. And I think more than anything, the opportunity to bring my teenage son to Standing Rock is what's driving me to be there and present.
How much do you think about the rubber bullets and pepper spray when you're bringing your son there?
Yeah, that's an issue, you know, just as a mom. You know, what am I doing going to the front lines with my child and seeing those images of the rubber bullets and watching the video with those audio grenades, or I'm not sure
concussion grenades.
Concussion grenades. And I'm going to make sure that we're protected to the best of our abilities. But yes, it is a choice to talk him through what may or may not happen. And I'm not necessarily nervous or scared to be there, but I'm cognizant of what may or may not happen. I feel that our presence is positive, but there's also that aspect of perhaps getting hit in the face or being arrested or being injured. So that's a reality.
What are you and your son thinking about North Dakota in November and how prepared you're going to be?
You know, growing up in Seattle, we're a very middle-of-the-road weather people. If it's above 80, I'm too hot. If it's below 40, I'm too cold. And I hear that at night it's starting to reach 20 degrees. And for me, that's freezing. But as I understand, this area consistently can be negative 40 degrees in the winter. So I have honestly no concept of what we're going into, but I have faith that going with a group of people with good hearts and strong networks will show up and we'll be okay.
What is at stake for you with this pipeline?
What's at stake for me is more than my present reality or immediate community or even this time period. What's at stake is our future. That this is much more than this one pipeline. It's about the whole industry and about corporate domination over politics and law and our health.
What's your goal? Move the pipeline? No pipeline? Keep the oil in the ground?
Honestly, I would hope that people look at the situation and wake up to what's happening in North America and understand that these decisions are being made regardless of human health or interest. And that's just it. We've been driven, in my opinion, by capitalism to live a lifestyle that's just not sustainable. And my hope with this attention in North Dakota on the pipeline is that people start thinking about alternative ways of living and thinking about not just the future generation, but generations to come.
You have not, or you've barely mentioned the word native or tribe. This is much bigger for you.
Yeah.
Or is it? I should ask. Is it way bigger than that?
The issue as I see it is, yes, there are thousands of native people, indigenous people, allies showing up in support of the tribe in North Dakota, the Standing Rock Sioux, to fight back against historical trauma and wrongs, especially broken treaties and broken promises. So that's absolutely an issue. But what's really profound to me is that the tribe has acknowledged all the millions of people living along the Missouri River. I don't know if they even recognize that their future is being protected and their future is being acknowledged, and that there's this group of activists who are seeing that reality and trying to do something about it now.
We talked on KUOW a few days ago with our state's former attorney general, and he said this project has been permitted. It's been researched. It's not that you don't have a right to protest, but this protest is illegal. You know, the decision's been made legally. How you're bringing your son into to civil disobedience? What do you and he say?
To be honest, it's hard for me to tell what exactly is legal and not legal. And I think it's easy to get mired in the legalities of the fine details. But I think what really matters is the impact of these decisions happening on a daily basis without regard to human life, environmental health, and the future of our Earth.
You wrote in The Stranger that there are tribal prophecies that foreshadow what's to come. What do you mean by that?
I have been present at elder and youth gatherings that are focused on spirituality and Indigenous pathways to spirituality, and a number of the elders who presented and shared their cultural prophecies had stated that there would be a black snake that would challenge the people and cause the people to rise up, as well as that Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous values would be what would save us one day from environmental disaster.
The black snake, meaning the pipeline?
Yes.
What do you think of that?
It resonates. You know, I'm speaking of a person who's a descendant of slaves, and my ancestors were killed through genocide, and I'm a mom. I live in assisted housing. I'm low income. And I feel that I have nothing to lose to be in support of the protesters and the water protectors, that our future depends on an alliance of Indigenous and non-Indigenous people coming together to assess and to fight for our right to a healthy future.
You have nothing to lose?
It's tricky. I'm a mom. I have two boys, and I want them to be proud of me and in the future to look back and see me as someone who fought for their future and their children's future.
Tracy Rector, curator, filmmaker, co-founder of Longhouse Media, recipient of the Stranger Genius Award, telling you why she and her 15-year-old son are joining the protests at Standing Rock, North Dakota. They leave on Wednesday, the day after the election. We're tweeting out a link to Tracy's article about her journey in The Stranger. So join us on Twitter at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Glad you're tuned in today. Earlier this week, we brought you a story about the support for Donald Trump among two different groups, Chinese nationals and Chinese American voters. And we mentioned seeing an airplane over Seattle on Friday pulling a banner that read, "Washington Chinese Americans for Trump." We've gotten dozens of responses to that story. KUOW's Amy Radel reported the story. She told Kim Malcolm what triggered those responses.
Well, our story featured an interview with a student at the University of Washington who's a Chinese national, and he said he's rooting for Trump as a tool to bring America down, a pretty inflammatory quote. And since there were no Chinese Americans interviewed in the story, it wasn't really clear that the two groups, Chinese Americans and Chinese nationals, have totally different reasons for supporting Trump among those that do. So as a result, KUOW received a lot of angry emails from Chinese American listeners who said that student doesn't represent their views. That wasn't the intent of the story, but it's an important distinction that our story has since clarified with an update. And I'd like to read you part of a note that we received from a Chinese American Trump supporter from here in our region. He's been involved with the campaign for Trump here, and he said, "Your news significantly misreported our initiatives and misled your readers and listeners. It looks like the whole Chinese American population are against the U.S., this great country, because you chose an unrelated student to represent us. Actually, as a silent minority and model citizens, we Chinese Americans no longer want to be silent, and this time we voiced out and voted."
So what is this group, Chinese Americans for Trump?
So the group was started by a California resident. His name is David Tian Wang. And he says this is the first election where he's seen a lot of Chinese Americans really get involved and become more vocal. He compared it to first love. They're in their they're in their first love. And he said he's excited for Chinese American voters to get engaged, even if they don't support Trump, even though he does, obviously. The people in his group like Trump's stances on issues like immigration and national security. The airplane banner idea has been happening in multiple states. It started with a supporter in Arizona, actually, who's also a pilot. And then people in different states started chipping in money to get those flights around the country, including here. It's been happening pretty fast. You might not find an office with Washington Chinese Americans for Trump. It's really just an informal network of volunteers.
So does Donald Trump have widespread support among Chinese Americans?
Not to the best of our research. There was a study released about a month ago by the National Asian American Survey, and its findings suggested that Asian Americans over the last 20 years have increased their support for Democratic presidential candidates more dramatically than any other group. So at least their results say they're shifting Democratic. The findings there suggested that 67% of Chinese Americans have an unfavorable view of Trump. So we're not saying that he's the candidate of choice for Chinese Americans necessarily. But we also heard from people who aren't necessarily Trump supporters. They just wanted to let us know that the inference in our piece upset them.
So that story aired Tuesday. What steps have you taken since then?
So we've added additional reporting with interviews with Chinese Americans for Trump to the story on our website. And we also posted excerpts of some of the really thoughtful emails that we've received since then. People had really good things to say. They're looking for media they can trust to accurately reflect their issues and concerns at this time when emotions around this election are running so high. So we're trying to show that we appreciate that.
That's KUOW reporter Amy Radle talking to our own Kim Malcolm. Meanwhile, the Democratic National Committee has taken the Republican National Committee to court, claiming Republicans are conspiring with the Trump campaign to intimidate minority voters and prevent them from casting ballots. We'll cover this story this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Also in election news, Senate Republicans are now talking about blocking any Supreme Court nominee from a prospective President Hillary Clinton, even if that means leaving the court stuck at 4-4 for 4 years. Can Republicans do that? Should they? We'll have that story coming up this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. It's KUOW's The Record. Good to have you along. I'm Bill Radke. Tonight, you can get into most of the art museums in Seattle and the galleries around Pioneer Square for free, this being First Thursday. There is a lot to see, so Stranger art critic Jen Graves is here to help you. She wants you to go see a show at Seattle University called Robots Building Robots. The idea is based on an engineering concept that started in the 1950s called Lights Out Manufacturing.
GM decided it wanted to have machines that would create products out of raw material without any human intervention. And so basically you could shut out the lights and you could shut off the heat. It would just be a building with stuff that made stuff.
Because you didn't need people with eyes.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or why was that an advantage?
The idea, is that you can cut down on costs and efficiency. I mean, basically machines can run 24 hours a day is the concept.
Right. You don't even need to be
labor.
No shifts.
No shifts.
Work all the time.
Work all the time. They didn't always succeed at their work.
Tell me about that.
Well, they made funny mistakes. Car painting robots ended up painting themselves sometimes. So it's like this hilarious comedy of errors.
Maybe they're just having a goof.
Yeah.
You know?
Just having a goof.
Yeah.
Or, you know, they're reflexive beings.
Ooh. Mm. So you walk into this show, Robots Building Robots, and you see what? What's
you
happening?
You do see some robots. You see a lot of works that are based on the principle that if you remove human beings from a process and you let us look at machines from the outside, we end up actually recognizing that we're very close to them.
Example, please.
So an example is there's a screen that is showing slides taken from Google Street View. And they have this like dry documentary appearance, but they are screwed up in one way or another. So like there'll be a bridge and parts of the railings will be like melted off. And when you see this slideshow of these images, you know, each one is like strange in some weird way. It can also be something as simple as like, like somebody's face is blurred out in something, and why their face would need to be blurred out when everybody else's face isn't. Or like, you know, there's like, so it's creepy technology. And at the same time, it's like really, it's really vulnerable and sort of sweet and produces these like, the gallery describes it as like unforeseen results coming from, you know, fact-based or rule-based systems.
And there's book highlighting, ebook highlighting.
Oh, yeah. So there's another work where the artist printed out versions of self-help books where all the text is whited out except for the parts that were crowdsourced by readers of ebooks. So when you highlight something in Kindle, say, it captures the fact that you highlighted that almost as a vote for that sentence.
Uh-huh.
And so the sentences that got all those votes are the ones that appear in this book. So it's like this annotated, like crowdsourced annotation. And it's like a very, very fast way to zip through the book.
Boils it down to the stuff we're all really interested in.
Exactly. And it's sort of like a self-help book about how to make yourself better by reading a self-help book better. So it's like this kind of crazy,
yeah.
You know, like very sweet sort of, it reveals something about human beings that is like, we totally don't want to admit, you know, that we're even reading them in the first place. But then also that like, we don't even have time to read them and we're like trying to get the fastest advice we can possibly get, you know. So it is like this kind of sweet, you know, exhibition. There's definitely like a creepy side and like the sort of surveillance and sort of upsetting nature of how entwined we are. But they're also, you know, these systems are here. They're not going anywhere. There's not kind of antagonism.
Would you tell us about facial recognition software?
Oh, yeah. That piece is really powerful. So this is a piece that it's a monitor. Your face appears on the screen and facial recognition software is trying to match you from a given database of 43 individuals who all are in the database as mugshots, headshots. And the 43 people turn out to be the 43 students who went missing in Mexico in, I believe, September 2014, and have really, the story of what happened to them has really never been accountably told by the government of Mexico.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. And so the technology, at first, it's sort of like, why are you trying to match me with this young boy, you know, this teenage boy? And then you start to kind of wish that it could match you when you figure out like, oh, this is somebody who's really gone and who people are actually still searching for, family members, you know, who couldn't possibly let go when they don't even know what happened. And you sort of sympathize with the machine's desire to just like, okay, well, let's just keep searching, you know, and you sort of hope that it's going to work. And of course, have this sense that like, it's not going to, you know, you're not one of these boys. And it's a very, it's very effective.
So again, this is not Big Bad Machine. You're on its side.
I think it's almost that the military and the police do use systems like this, right? And people's lives are hurt by using systems like this. Like sometimes those systems misidentify people, and sometimes they miss things, and those are like really heartbreaking cases too. So the technology is not a sort of innocent player. It's just that it has this additional side of really, in this work, really like trying to aid this emotional need to search and find answers. It's like you have the feeling that this system, this you know, facial recognition software has better intentions than the government.
Yeah, that's more interesting than the evil.
Yeah.
The evil computer coming to get you.
It's much more interesting to me, too.
So bottom line, you're now, Jen, more welcoming of our robot overlords or less welcoming of our robot overlords for seeing this show?
I think I just feel closer to the technology than I knew I was. Because when I look at these things and I realize their sort of frailties, you know, I just sort of feel like, oh, I recognize that. Like we're two sentient beings like looking at each other and going like, oh, yeah, I know what it's like to be vulnerable like that, to make errors or to, you know,
right.
go wrong.
Freeze up.
Yeah. And so I think it actually sort of relates a little bit less to the kind of like protest of technology or the sort of sci-fi side, but and links more to like the hacker side. Like, okay, if these, you know, technologies can be more familiar than I realized when I use them, like what else can I do with them, and how else can I think about them, and how else do I already relate to them in a way that could be used for the things that I believe in: connection, telling truths, beauty, you know, love. I mean, stuff like that.
Stuff you know, like that.
Stuff like that.
That's the Strangers art critic Jen Graves on Robots Building Robots. It's a show at Seattle University's Hadrian Gallery, and tonight admission is free. We are tweeting out a link for the show at KUOW. This is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. A month after the National Museum of African American History and Culture opened in D.C., crowds are nonstop, and the staff have gotten a different reaction to the museum than what they expected. You'll hear more about that this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. In Washington state, there are about 20,000 self-identified Muslims. We don't have clear statistics on their voting preferences, but we know some are voting for Donald Trump. And you might wonder why a Muslim would support a candidate who's called for a ban on people of their faith from entering the United States. So reporter Hiba Fisher went to a Republican viewing party of a presidential debate in Seattle. She went there with a local Muslim.
Lose our seats here, so let's just sit down here.
Are you excited about tonight?
Oh, absolutely. We're going to have the key to the White House starting from tonight.
This is Hossein Khorram, an Iranian Muslim American. He's been a member of the Republican Party for 15 years.
Good evening, everyone. Are we ready for a great debate?
The energy that night was high as Republican Party staff passed around Trump signs, debate bingo cards, and banners saying deplorable and proud.
We own that property. We also own.
After the debate, I met up with Hossein to talk more. He's a real estate developer in downtown Bellevue, so we met in one of his buildings. Most of the tenants are older Iranian men and women who are voting for Trump for the same reasons as Hossein. Many fled Iran from persecution during the Islamic Revolution, and they feel that Trump will be tougher against Iran in foreign policy. Hossein grew up in northern Tehran, and in the 1970s, the revolution began.
I clearly recall the inception of the revolution in Iran, and that's when everything went south.
As the revolution escalated, Hossein's parents sent him off to study in the U.S., and they joined shortly after. But his father would go back and forth between the U.S. and Iran for work. On one trip back, Hossein's father went hunting with some friends and was stopped by revolutionary guards. They claimed the group was planning a coup against the regime. They were arrested and told they would be executed. The guards blindfolded them, lined them up, but instead of shooting at them, shot into the air.
It took him a few minutes to kind of touch and figure out which world they're in. Is it this world or the next? After like a minute or so, they figure out, no, they're not dead yet. They're still here.
The guard said they would kill them tomorrow. This went on for days. Hossein's father didn't know whether he was going to live or die. And keep in mind, at the time, Hossein, his brother, and his mom were thousands of miles away in the United States.
It was very, very difficult times. We were very, very worried about this whole thing and how this is going to turn out. We just didn't know.
Eventually, Hossein's father was transferred to another prison where he was detained for 8 months and eventually released.
They had confiscated everything that my family had. Everything was taken away. Everything.
Up until this point, Hossein and his family were not really that interested in politics. But after the capture of his father everything changed.
Our life became political. I became active in the Iranian resistance to the regime. The one thing that compels me to the Trump campaign is just the way appeasement policies have not paid off.
By appeasement, Hussein means the signing of the Iranian nuclear deal, a deal Hillary Clinton helped author and Trump has called the worst deal America has made. And when it comes to Trump's ban on Muslims entering the United States, Hussein says he doesn't think Trump really means that.
I don't think it's American tradition to ban people of any religion. That's against our constitution. But I would say there may be a temporary halt, a place like Syria, where we can check the backgrounds so we get a little better handle on this whole thing. I have no problem with that.
Now, not all Muslims in Washington feel the same way.
Trump is the wrong choice for us. He's just the wrong choice because what he's saying is very dangerous.
This is Ghassan Mansour, a Lebanese-American Muslim. He's a real estate agent and a longtime justice activist. In his office in Linwood, he has photos of himself standing with Nelson Mandela, President Obama.
His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, and me with the Secretary of State, John Kerry, is a great man. Pope of Egypt, he was here several months ago.
Ghassan grew up in Lebanon, and he moved to the States in 1984. He was a Bernie Sanders supporter to begin with. Now, he supports Hillary, but he, like Hussein, doesn't believe she'll be good for Middle East foreign policy.
If we look at her policy to the Middle East, it has been wrong. You know, we know that. But the Middle East is a complex situation. The bottom line, we are American. We have to think of America first at this point. That's the only country I have.
Can you tell me what's at stake if Trump were to become president for you and your family as Muslims in America?
Let me tell you what my son said to me a couple months ago. He said, Dad, I don't want to die in the crossfire. Our children are afraid to go to school because they're Muslim. They've been bullied.
And hate crimes against Muslims in America today are at their highest since after 9/11.
We know what Trump wants. He want to decrease Muslim American from this country. He doesn't want us here. We know that. He want to bring America back to if you're brown, if you are black, if you are Muslim, you don't belong here. What's at stake here is really America.
And that seems to be what most Muslims can agree on. No matter what side of the debate they fall, whether for Trump or for Hillary, a lot is at stake. And the decisions we make this election will chart a new tone for America. In Bellevue, I'm Hibba Fisher for KUOW.
Hibba Fisher is the co-founder of Kerning Cultures, a podcast about the politics, culture, and history of the Middle East. And you'll find a link to it at our website, kuow.org. And here's a news update. Today, Britain's plans to leave the European Union just hit a speed bump. The country's high court has ruled the government cannot begin exit negotiations without a vote in Parliament. The ruling is raising hopes among pro-EU politicians that they can at least soften the terms of the UK's withdrawal. It's KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Thanks for tuning in to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. A report from Australian investigators offers new clues about the greatest aviation mystery of the 21st century, the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. The jet disappeared over the Gulf of Thailand in 2014. Well, based on a fresh satellite analysis and newly found debris, investigators say they now think the plane plunged rapidly into the southern Indian Ocean. Well, that scenario might help answer questions about the plane's final minutes, but it still doesn't explain why it went down. Seattleite Blaine Allen Gibson has been searching for answers. He's been searching for Flight 370. He calls it travel with a purpose. I asked Gibson what makes him qualified to solve this mystery.
Well, my sources and qualifications are that I'm willing to look at this with an open mind and think outside of the box to try to go find out what happened.
This is not your first mystery.
No, it's not my first mystery, but it's my first mystery that has to do with a missing plane.
What other mysteries have you pursued?
I worked on some archaeological expeditions to try to discover what happened to the Maya in Guatemala and Belize.
The Mayan civilization?
The Mayan civilization. I went to the epicenter of the Tunguska meteorite in Siberia. I was the second American ever to go in there to try to figure out what that was. And I went looking for the lost Ark of the Covenant in Ethiopia. So I've...
How'd that go?
Well, I didn't find it, but I think I know about where it is.
And why did you decide you needed to unravel the mystery of Malaysian Air Flight 370?
Well, this combines a lot of the things that really interest me. Aviation, science, physics, oceanography. I fly a lot. And also geopolitics and law, because there are a lot of different countries and interests involved in this search. And so after starting to read and learn about it, I went to the one-year commemoration and met a lot of the family members. And that gave me an extra inspiration to try to solve this mystery, because it's not just like I'm trying to figure out what happened to an old civilization. I am trying to find out what happened to these people. I cannot imagine, even though they've told me, how these families feel. Absolutely no contact at all, no information whatsoever on what happened to their loved ones for almost 2.5 years.
What do you remember about finding out about the downing of that plane that day, and what clicked for you that said, I'm on this?
What really clicked for me was when I found out that it didn't just disappear off the civilian radar and crash in the Gulf of Thailand, that it actually crossed back over into the Straits of Malacca, up towards the Andaman Sea, and then disappeared off the military radar, and yet, according to the Inmarsat data, flew on for about 7 hours. And there's never been anything really quite like that. With all the other plane crashes, we've known where they crashed. We really don't know where this crashed, and the only real clue we have is the Inmarsat satellite data and its interpretation, and some eyewitness accounts, some of which are consistent with it and some of which conflict with it.
One of the things that fascinates me about you and your story is the community of people out there who you've tapped,
yes,
who have different, the civilians and formers who you've tapped and put on your team. What kind of specialists have you collected on Facebook and elsewhere?
Private citizens like myself who are very interested in solving this mystery, one, because they also love solving mysteries and love aviation, and two, because they want to bring answers to the families. These are concerned private citizens doing it out of good motivations to try to get answers. Some of them are specialists in engineering who understand the satellites. Some are pilots who can understand the fuel calculations. Others are simply good at Googling and looking for plane parts and telling me if something is part of a plane. And others are very good with politics and things like that to try to understand who might be behind some of the information and disinformation efforts going out there. So it's been very interesting. I've got a great group of people.
From the Seattle area, some of them?
They're from all over the world, from England, from Australia, from Indonesia.
What did it feel like to find that first piece of debris from that plane?
When I saw it, I knew it was from a plane because it had no step written on it. The press asked me if I was happy. And the answer is no. Happy would have been if I had landed on that sandbank and found 239 people grilling shrimp and sipping on coconuts saying, "What took you so long?" That's happy. But we want to find the truth, whatever it is. And what I had hoped to find were some clues that would lead us to that truth. And the no-step panel that I found showed that at least the tail shattered on impact. And what was really good from the no-step panel was that after the press coverage of that came out, other people started to look and find things. A teenager in South Africa said, "Oh, I saw one of those. I saw it on a beach in Mozambique. I picked it up and brought it home." So there's a second piece. An archaeologist found a piece in South Africa. A couple found a piece of cabin debris in Rodriguez, and they all said that they only recognized it because of the press coverage of what I had found. So that is very good.
Blaine, you say the Malaysian Air Flight 370 mystery must be solved.
Yes.
Why must it be solved?
For one thing, we owe it to the families to give them answers of what happened to their loved ones. And the flying public feels that way. Imagine when you get on a plane, if you think that this plane could just disappear and my loved ones could never, ever know what happened to me. That is a torture that to me is unimaginable. So for the families themselves, we owe it to them to give them answers, but also for the flying public. People need to know that they're not going to just disappear. Maybe there'll be a crash, maybe there'll be a tragedy, but we'll always be able to find out what happened and why.
How much money have you spent on this?
I don't add it up, and the reason I don't is that I love traveling, and for example, when I went to Mozambique, it was because I've had the goal to go to every country in the world since I was 7 years old, and Mozambique was one I'd never been to. But while I was there, knowing the currents and drift, I thought, well, I might find some piece of Malaysia 370 here. So I chartered a boat for $240. I had asked around local boatmen and fishermen, where do things tend to wash ashore? This is Africa. People beachcomb and collect things that they can use. The boatman told me, Junior from Dolphin Dhow Safaris, that the Paluma Sandbank is a place where fishermen go to get buoys and nets and things they can use. So I said, let's go there. We walked around on the Paluma Sandbank, and it was mostly just regular beach junk. And then suddenly, Junior picks up and is holding this light gray triangular-shaped panel, and I walk towards it, and it says no step on it. And I just thought, wow, this is it.
Amazing. So you've incorporated this mystery, this obsession, if you will, into your life of travel. You're on the Paluma Sandbank in Mozambique.
It's not an obsession. It is a mission.
A mission.
It is a quest.
At what point do you decide it's not worth searching anymore? You give up.
When I or someone else finds the plane and, most important, what happened to it and what happened to the passengers.
But that could be years away, if ever.
It could be.
You'll never give up?
No, I'm not going to give up. I'm going to keep trying. And like I said, this is not an obsession. This is a mission. I have another life. I do other things. But until this mystery is solved, I am not going to stop trying to solve it and looking for it.
And if someone else, after all you've been through, if someone else solves the mystery before you, how would you feel?
Absolutely wonderful. I would be very happy that the mystery is solved. I would immediately want to meet them, congratulate them, and buy them a beer. This is not a competition. We're all looking for the truth. And if someone does it, wonderful. I embrace it.
Blaine Allen Gibson of Seattle, trying to find out what happened to Malaysian Air Flight 370. March 8th, 2014, the plane was flying over the Gulf of Thailand when it disappeared. You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Yesterday on this show, I spoke with a Seattle woman who designed a system for composting human remains. So instead of buying a cemetery plot or getting cremated, you can decompose into soil. And your loved ones can use your soil to, I don't know, mulch the backyard plum tree. KUOW social media producer Bon Huberman, how do our listeners take that?
Okay, so at least one listener has reservations. Lee writes, it feels like it crosses a line of respect for human life, which should be different from cabbages and spoiled tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone else is on board. Daniel says, I hope to have my body composted, planted in the garden directly, and I thought it would be cool to have my skeleton cleaned, parentheses, beetles, question mark.
That's a real thing. You can go hunt a deer and take its skull to some place that puts it in a bucket full of bugs.
Had no idea. Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. Anyway, so post beetle cleaning, he would be donated to the anthropology department at my alma mater, mm-hmm. which is a lovely way to become an alumni
yes.
donor. Ian, master composter, loves the idea. He says it's such an obvious and healthy solution to the problem of what to do with a dead human, and I'm delighted that it looks like it's becoming a choice for me. I'm 68. I plan to live until this scheme is up and running.
Oh, we hope that for you, Ian. Bond, were you persuaded one way or the other? Are you in?
Absolutely. I love to give back.
Your mulch? What do you want to come back as?
I think a dogwood tree.
A dogwood. I have a dogwood. Those are lovely.
Yeah, I want everyone to remember, you know, how pretty I was.
It is very true. Bon Huberman, thank you for everybody who listened and wrote in. If you missed it and you want to learn more about human composting, they call it recompositioning, you'll find that interview at KUOW.org. And we'll tweet out a link right now to the full interview. So we are on Twitter at KUOW. Finally, Whitman College in Walla Walla has just picked a new nickname to replace the old Missionaries. The school says the Missionaries mascot was considered non-inclusive, imperialistic. It incorrectly implied that Whitman's a religious school. So after surveying students, faculty, staff, alumni, Whitman teams will now be known as the Blues. You may know the Blues are a mountain range near Walla Walla. And quick reaction on Twitter today comes from Ginny, who writes, "The Whitman Blues is literally what I refer to my depression as." Other finalists not chosen, Appaloosas, the Blue Ravens, and also Whitman is not the Sockeyes.